Hello everyone, and welcome to another Apply Clubs event hosted by EASAS Network. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we start with a new series called Antro Tech Talk, hosted by two techno-anthropology graduates, Miguel Gomez-Hernandez and Markus Rothmüller. In our first event, we have the pleasure of listening to three speakers. Yolandi Strangers, a professor of digital technology and society at the Emerging Technologies Research Lab in Monash University. Jenny Waycott, who's an associate professor in School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne. And finally, Professor Kimball Marriott, who's a professor in computer science in Monash University, with the topic Aging Technology, Sociology, Anthropology, and Human-Computer Interaction. We hope you're gonna enjoy this episode, and please don't forget to follow us on our social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Slack, and more, which you can find in the show notes.
I found this event, this discussion, as an interesting occasion to talk about aging technologies through interdisciplinary perspectives, because over time we are increasingly becoming more engaged in interdisciplinary teams among anthropologists, among social scientists and computer scientists. And sometimes we don't know each other's disciplines that well. We have some questions that we would like to uncover throughout this discussion with three panelists. I will briefly introduce each of the panelists. First of all is Professor Yolandi Strangers. She's Professor of Digital Technology and Society at the Emerging Technologies Research Lab in Monash University. Yolandi is a digital sociologist and human-computer interaction professor investigating the sustainability and inclusion impacts of digital and smart technologies, including emerging forms of AI. She has also focused on the growing interest in smart home technologies that can assist older adults to continue living at home. Yolandi undertakes design ethnographic research to understand how people and sometimes their pets incorporate new technologies into their everyday lives and homes. Past and current partners include ANZ Bank, Ausgrid, AusNet Services, Energy Consumers Australia, and Intel Corporation. She leads the Energy Futures Research Program in the Emerging Technologies Research Lab. Also, I'd like to say that we have tried to find an interdisciplinary panel, but as well who have some engagement with industry, either through work experience or through projects with industry in aging technologies. Then Jenny Waycott is an associate professor in the School of Computing and Information Systems, the University of Melbourne, working in the interdisciplinary field of human-computer interaction. Much of her research aimed to understand how new technologies can be designed and used to foster social well-being in later life. Waycott leads a program of research that is examining how emerging technologies such as virtual reality and social robots are used by caregivers and older adults to provide social and emotional enrichment in later life, especially for people living in aged care. More broadly, Waycott is interested in ethical issues associated with designing and evaluating new technologies, including AI, for use in sensitive settings such as aged care, where a respectful and empathetic approach is critical to ensure new technologies provide benefit without causing harm. And finally, Professor Kimball Marriott, he's professor in the Department of Human-Centered Computing at Monash University. Kim is a professor in computer science. After obtaining his PhD in 1989, he worked at the IBM T.J. Watson Research Center until joining Monash in 1993. He has over 200 research publications and is best known for his research into assistive technologies for people who are blind, or have low visions and data visualization. Kim is also the director of the newly created Monash Assistive Technology and Society Center. So thank you very much for coming today, the panelists. I will say again, we will have now a 5 minutes presentation for each of the panelists, where they will introduce an experience or an instance working with older people and technology. Then we will have a 25 minutes discussion with some questions we prepared. And finally, 25 minutes discussion with audience. So who wants to start? Okay, let's say Yolandi, I see you were smiling, so do you mind starting?
Of course, yeah. Never ask the panelists to nominate themselves to start. But I'm happy to go first. Thank you very much for that introduction, and it's really a pleasure to be here and be part of this community this evening. I'm joining from the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung lands of the Kulin Nation here in Melbourne, in Australia, and just wanted to pay my respects to Elders past, present and emerging. Invite anybody on Indigenous lands to also acknowledge where you are today. So I fell into the aging space in many ways in my work. I have been focusing on smart technologies and smart homes for a number of decades, really, and older people have always sort of been part of my research, but not really a focus until quite recently. They really sort of started to get on my radar as an interesting and important group to be looking at more closely in a project where we were giving participants these little devices called smart plugs or smart lights, really simple sort of plug and play smart technology. And it was for a project with the energy sector, and I was just really trying to find out whether or not people use these devices to engage in any kind of energy saving actions in their homes, just at a very simple level, whether they were willing to engage in smart control and smart home technologies. And with that trial, we found that a quarter of our participants didn't engage in the smart control at all. These are people who'd signed up to receive these products. They'd volunteered to be part of this trial. A quarter of them didn't even kind of engage with the products at all. Some of them didn't even get them out of the box. A quarter tried to install them but failed. So that left us with only half of the participants who are actually actively using them. And what was interesting about it was that anybody over the age of 55 was far more likely to not be using the devices. And they were all, everybody who had not actually engaged with using the device at all were in that age bracket. And they were often waiting for someone to sort of help them, and a family member or a, you know, a relative, you know, son, daughter, etc., and they just hadn't kind of arrived yet, so they really didn't feel confident enough to engage with what is often considered quite a simple technology. So that was sort of my first experience of thinking, okay, there's something really important here, because, you know, in my interest with energy technologies and the energy transition, you know, if there's a whole cohort of people who can't engage in the technology that's meant to realize that transition, then we've got a really big problem. So the next project I sort of got involved with in a more serious way with older people was called Smart Homes for Seniors. And that was a partnership with an aged care provider here in Australia called McLean Care, and also with Deakin University with my colleagues at the Emerging Technologies Research Lab. And that was a much more kind of tailored program of research around introducing a whole raft of smart home technologies into around 20 households in regional New South Wales and Queensland, which are two states of Australia here, to sort of see how older people incorporated these devices into their lives and their homes. And we did quite extensive ethnographic research as part of that. I'm working with Sarah Pink, who many of you would know. She's an anthropologist here, and she's the director of the Emerging Technologies Lab. So it was a very interdisciplinary project, also working with HCI designers, which I'm sort of a bit of a hybrid HCI person as well. So it's a great example of interdisciplinary research. We had a technical team tracking the actual usage of the devices, what people, for instance, were asking voice assistants, and, you know, how they were engaging with robotic vacuum cleaners and all sorts of devices. And then we had the ethnographic team really following the experience and working really closely with the participants to understand how they use the devices. So I've only got 5 minutes, so I just thought I'd show you a little trailer from a documentary film that we made from that particular project. It's an ethnographic film, and it was directed by Sarah Pink. And it also features our colleague, Melissa Ducu, who was the lead researcher on that this particular piece of work as well. So I just thought I'd play that as a little intro to this particular project, and it can hopefully open up some more discussion. So I'll just share my screen. Here we go.
Do you always say please when you talk to Google?
I do. It's only habit. Manners.
There are still many unanswered questions about how and where digital home technologies really fit into older people's lives.
It's a bit daunting for someone of my age when you've got all this new technology I haven't been brought up with.
This film joins a group of older people on their 6 month journey of living with smart home technologies in 2020. Our research team met with them in their homes in regional Australia.
And you do need bright lighting in your bathroom at our age, because you can't afford to have anything on the floor because you're easily tripped over.
Gone everywhere, it's not marking out everywhere, you know.
One day I said, hey Google, turn the kettle and turn the jug on.
Nothing happened.
Didn't it?
Sorry, I don't understand.
Edna and Bob, Hilda and Owen, Beryl and David, Robert, Helen and Ken, John and Shirley, showed us where smart home technologies brought new value and joy into their lives, where they became frustrated with them, where they needed support, and when they were concerned about the cost of internet access, electricity, and technologies. If they're accompanied by the right social values, ethics, usability interfaces, and services, smart technologies can support older generations to stay safe, independent, and actively participating as our world rapidly changes.
So there you go, that's a little intro to Smart Homes for Seniors. And I think I'll leave it there, and happy to talk further about that piece of work and some of the things that we found when we get to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Yolandi. I left the full documentary link on the chat. So maybe now Jenny or Kim, anyone keen to continue? Okay. I think Jenny is unmuted herself. Or?
Yeah, and so is Kim. I could see Kim talking. Kim, do you have a preference?
No, not at all. I think we just need to be told.
Yes. Okay. Do you want me to go jump in then?
Yeah, great. Excellent.
Okay, thank you. I'll share my screen. I've taken a slightly different approach, and I'm just presenting some slides from recent talks I've given on the topic. I was a last minute addition to the program, so I'm just trying to find, there we go. Once I share. Is that all that's visible for you?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to do my best to keep this within 5 minutes. I just wanted to talk to you about the use of immersive virtual reality for enrichment in aged care. And this is a small piece of a larger project that I've been doing, looking at a range of emerging technologies that have been used for enrichment in later life. This is part of a project that I applied for in 2016. And at the time when I wrote the proposal for this project, virtual reality was being introduced into residential care homes. So when I say aged care, I'm referring to homes, long-term care facilities for older people who are no longer able to live independently at home. So they're often quite frail and they have complex care needs. And I was really curious at the time that I put the proposal in about this use of virtual reality that I was seeing in the news. So there were news reports appearing about technology companies introducing virtual reality in aged care. I wasn't seeing at the time a lot of research. That has changed a lot since then. But at the time, I was seeing technology companies being profiled, but I was really curious about whether any research was being done, and I wanted to know, you know, what were the benefits of virtual reality and what were the challenges, because this was a really complex, sensitive setting, and it's quite a, you know, complex emerging technology to be introducing into this environment. And so that was the motivation for the project. And you can see there, sorry, that video was supposed to play while I was talking, but never mind, I shall move on to the next slide. So what do we mean by enrichment in aged care? And I think the best way to explain this is actually to use an example from one of my participants. So this research involved interviews, mostly with caregivers, about their use of virtual reality in aged care homes. And I was kind of surprised to hear so many stories about how enriching this experience was. And to illustrate what I mean by enrichment, I think it's easiest just to show you an example. And so this is an example from a volunteer that I spoke to who was going into aged care homes and introducing virtual reality on a one-to-one basis with people he met who had particular interests and needs that he thought could be addressed through these immersive virtual reality experiences. So in this particular example, he described working with a man who was turning 100 and he was a car fanatic. And when the volunteer asked about what he wanted to do, what was the dream that he had that he hadn't been able to fulfill, he said, "I would love to be able to sit in a Formula One race car." So the volunteer went into VR, found a Formula One race car experience, put the headset, the goggles on this 100-year-old man, and he did a lap at the track in Germany, hollering at the top of his voice, whooping and hollering, having such a ball. And it's something that he continued to talk about with his family because he got to live this dream. So I think that's a really illustrative example of the idea that the technology, when used in this really personal way, can create these opportunities for moments of joy, which are quite enriching for people whose lives are otherwise very constrained. But immersive VR is a double-edged sword. So the full immersion is what gives you a lot of the joy and enrichment. And so I've seen lots of examples of this personalized engagement, like we just saw. It's being used to provide diversion and relaxation and to resurface memories through virtual travel. So for example, another example that's come from my interviews is using VR for virtual travel and uncovering memories of past experiences of travel and adventure that then become shared with the care home staff and become part of, you know, part of what the staff know about that person. And I'm just racing a little bit because I'm aware that I'm going to run out of time. But the other side of the sword is that full immersion can be frightening. It's clearly going to be uncomfortable to wear the heavy virtual reality headsets in an aged care environment. And a key part of using virtual reality well in aged care is that it requires careful facilitation by a staff member or a volunteer, someone working closely with that person. And that is really difficult when someone is immersed in a virtual world. And I have an example here that really illustrates this issue quite vividly. So one staff member I spoke to described a man who had accidentally ended up standing on the edge of a cliff and had a really, really frightening experience, but didn't immediately tell her what he had experienced. And it was difficult for her to understand that experience because he was wearing the headset. And so it was difficult to observe that sense of fear. So I think it's really important to understand these challenges alongside the benefits of something like virtual reality being used in aged care, because if we just focus on all these opportunities and benefits, then we may end up, you know, causing harm. So my key lessons from this body of work is that VR experiences do need to be carefully selected, deployed, facilitated, and monitored when used for personalized enrichment in aged care. Any decisions about using new technologies in aged care should be based on a deep understanding of the needs and interests of the individuals being cared for. And the risks of new technologies need to be carefully managed through one-to-one facilitation. And this raises a question for me, which is how can we best use technology for personalized enrichment in these environments when this actually requires more staff time to do it well. And I think there's a common narrative around technology in care, suggesting that technology makes things more efficient. But actually, if you're using it for this personalised enrichment, it requires more time and attention. I'm going to finish up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jenny, for your wonderful presentation. Now it's time for Kim to present a visual instance of your work with aging technologies.
Thanks, Mingo. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Like Yolande, I'd like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation and to the peoples of other First Nations on whose land people attending remotely are standing, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. So as you've heard, my background, I'm much more of a computer scientist. My background is in computer science and technology. The reason I'm here is because I work in assistive technology, and I'm actually director of the newly created Monash Assistive Technology and Society Centre, which I encourage you to look for and find out more about. I'm not an expert in assistive technology and ageing. Rather, I work a lot in assistive technology for or with the blind and low vision community. However, vision loss is age-related, so many of the people that we work with are older. Nearly 10% of adults greater than or older than 55 have vision, you know, a serious vision impairment. And I've also got personal experience of ageing. You know, I've had two older parents with dementia, hearing and vision loss. The sort of technologies that I use or work with, 3D printing, artificial intelligence, particularly conversational agents, computer vision, image enhancement, and mixed reality displays. I'm going to talk about one relevant project. So I'll just share on screen. And this was with the Bendigo Art Gallery. Bendigo is a small regional centre about 200 kilometres, 150 kilometres north of Melbourne. And it's got an absolutely excellent art gallery, which has exhibits that, you know, people from around Victoria and even around Australia come to visit. So because of that, the art gallery is a huge part, big part of the community. Everyone who lives in Bendigo goes along to the art gallery to see the latest exhibition. Everybody's talking about it. And the Bendigo Art Gallery realised that for blind and low vision people, well, this was quite a big issue because it's not only important for the blind and low vision people to have access to the art itself, but also for social connection. So we, as part of this project, we talked to, you know, blind and low vision people working or living in the area, and one of them has said how out there everybody is talking about the exhibition and you really aren't able to contribute to that unless you've actually been to the exhibition and experienced the exhibition, and at the moment we can't do that. So over the last 5 years, we've had a project with the Bendigo Art Gallery to open up their collection to blind and low vision visitors. We use a mix of sound and touch and new technologies to provide blind and low vision people with access. So I'm just going to look at two exhibitions. So one of those was an exhibition by the fashion designer, or exhibition about the work of the fashion designer Mary Quant. And there we created a variety of different ways of accessing the exhibition, but one of them was these cards with the fabric shaped into the different sorts of costumes that she created. But, you know, obviously texture is really important, and our participants, blind and low vision visitors, really appreciated being able to feel the different textures of the fabrics and understand, get a sense of the sort of design that Mary Quant was responsible for. Our next exhibition that we dealt with was an Olvis exhibition. So we had, or the gallery had teamed up with Graceland and had a lot of Olvis paraphernalia, which was, you know, a huge exhibition. There were hundreds of thousands of visitors. We ran two tours for blind and low vision people. I think about 40 people went through. And there, one way we showed the exhibition was a low vision artist who was part of the team created a huge diorama of Elvis's life. So starting in on the left was the little shack that he grew up in. Then there was a train that you followed with buttons that you could press to get more information, you know, Hollywood sign, and then leading across to the Graceland Mansion, you know, and you can compare and see how large the Graceland Mansion was compared with the other one and, you know, how his life had changed. We also used music in the center image at the bottom is new technology called refreshable tactile displays. So this provided animations that you could feel, which allowed you to understand the dance moves that Elvis was making. And on the left was a display that we designed for deafblind participants, which actually allowed you to hear and feel the music using pulsating balloons. So primarily because the audience that we were catering for were older adults. And one of these was an older woman who had, until she became blind, had been a gallery guide. So she'd had a very strong connection with the Bendigo Art Gallery. But when she became blind, she just stopped going there, didn't want to have anything more to do with it, and had sort of, because she felt that she couldn't contribute or experience it. So she was really overjoyed to have the opportunity to be able to experience the gallery again, exhibits again, and to actually connect with the people in the gallery. So that was, I think, this is a really good example of using assistive technology to provide older people with access and, importantly, increasing their engagement with community, with the surrounding community. I'll leave it there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Kim, for your presentation. As you said, low vision is something that a lot of older people are going through, and that's why your experience is very meaningful in this sense. But now we have a set of questions for you that you can feel free to participate, or if you don't have an answer, that's also totally fine. We can go to the next question. So my first question for you is, using your interdisciplinary academic and industry backgrounds in sociology, anthropology, psychology, and computer science or human-computer interaction, which challenges and opportunities do you find researching and developing technologies for older people, even if compared to other age groups or other demographics? And how do you use your disciplines in different ways to tackle those opportunities and challenges? I hope it makes sense. If not, I can rephrase my question.
I guess I'll start just because I was last speaking. So I'm going to start with opportunities. I mean, clearly, well, within Australia, there's been a Royal Commission into aged care, which has highlighted massive problems with the current way that older Australians are treated in Australia and the way aged care works. There's clearly huge issues with aging populations, increasing dementia, et cetera. So the opportunity is that there's lots of potential impact that the work that we can do can have. And there's also potentially a lot of funding to actually allow us to do really good and important work. As a technologist, I see lots of new and emerging technology that can be useful. I mean, the obvious one we've been talking about is AI, so intelligent assistants, conversational agents, also computer vision, so, you know, particularly for blind and low vision people. I mean, my mother-in-law ended up being put into hospital because her partner was giving her the wrong medication or neglected to give her medication for a couple of days. You know, there's some sort of intelligent assistant would have been wonderful and, you know, would have been able to help. You know, intelligent conversational interfaces for all appliances and devices rather than touch or buttons, because touch screens are really inaccessible for older people, you know, for a variety of reasons. So changing that sort of interface, monitoring falls, you know, using AI to reduce scams, improved hearing aids, smart glasses, maybe robotic companions, telepresence to bring people into, you know, family members living away, etc. I think that all of these are big opportunities. But what are the challenges? Well, you know, frailty, multiple disabilities, lack of technology literacy, lack of confidence. As I talked about, difficulty using touch devices. I think there's also a problem in the tech community that it tends to be dominated by young people, and they're not really aware or understand the importance of designing for older people. And so there, I think really co-design is really, really important, making sure that you're involving older adults, older people in the design. I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you.
Can I jump in and add to that? So I agree with all of those, you know, opportunities and challenges. And I just wanted to, the interdisciplinary perspective that you asked about, I was, you know, thinking about that after you asked the question. And I think human-computer interaction, which is the discipline I'm in, is kind of interdisciplinary, inherently interdisciplinary. And so I'm kind of used to sort of using different perspectives as I approach these issues. And one thing that means is that I think it's really important to see the way technology is being used in context, and to understand that it's not a black or white situation. It's not necessarily that this technology is good in this situation or bad in this situation. There's often lots of areas of grey, and it's really important to understand those and to understand how we can get the best out of technology to improve people's lives, to improve care, to support care, while minimizing the risks and challenges and negative impacts that it might have on people. But one challenge that I have is that sometimes it's hard to ensure that perspective, that holistic view, is shared by others involved in the research or in the technology development and deployment. So, yeah, I'm not sure how to make sure people do look holistically at the best ways to design and use technologies in different settings and for different people. Like, there's no one size fits all solution. That's one key thing that's come out of the work I've been doing, is that everybody has individual interests, needs, preferences. You know, we assume that older people aren't interested in technology, but I've encountered a lot of older people who are interested in technology. And so we can't kind of put everyone in the same category. So, yeah, that makes it quite challenging. Thanks.
So, I think it's a really interesting question about what the different disciplines bring. And I guess I sit across anthropology, sociology, and human-computer interaction, so I can kind of speak to those three. So for me, sociology sort of gives me that ability to ask very big questions about whether technology is even the answer or the right solution for whatever the problem is. I find often with HCI, you know, in any computing discipline, everybody is sort of this inherent assumption that technology will be the answer. And so the whole project is sort of designed around how do we create a better technology? How do we improve the technology? Whereas as a sociologist, I can often take a step back and ask a question like, you know, is technology the best way to solve this particular issue in the aging sector or to address the aged care crisis or to respond to that loneliness epidemic or whatever it might be? So there's kind of a nice step back position there that I think sociology can give. And also that's what sociology does. It asks those really big kind of social questions. And it's nice to be freed from the requirement to have technology as the answer. So that's good, I think. Where I really like HCI though is it's very experimental. It's very, I think it actually is a lot more innovative in many ways than the social sciences. The social sciences can be quite restrictive and very traditional, have particular methods and theoretical pathways that are very hard to diverge from. HCI kind of throws everything into the mix sometimes. You can argue whether that's good or bad, but it does free up the field and the discipline. And it also is very oriented towards practical outcomes, like how do we improve this very, you know, specific thing? Or how can we test this thing with a group of people? So I think that's a really interesting kind of opportunity for HCI as a discipline. And then anthropology is really where I draw a lot of my methodological grounding and inspiration, you know, particularly with the ethnographic methods that I spoke about earlier. And ethnography is just such a great way of hearing people's perspectives from their own, you know, walks of life, really trying to understand whatever the issue is, you know, how it kind of translates into somebody's personal circumstances, and also allowing them to kind of tell their own story. I really love Sarah's, you know, method that she's developed over many years of documentary filmmaking from anthropology, because, you know, to that industry question that you asked, Miguel, I mean, that it just is such a powerful way of elevating those stories. I mean, I led the report and Sarah led the film, and I can tell you which one has got more attention. It's definitely not the report. So, although I think it might have taken a lot more time. So, yeah, there's a lesson for me in that as well, in terms of, you know, how's the best way to get the message out and to engage the right stakeholders or the right people in whatever it is that you're trying to do. And I think anthropology has some, you know, amazing capabilities there. So, yeah, some strengths and some weaknesses, I think, from the different disciplines there and how they can kind of amplify some of the work that we're doing with older people.
So I'd just like to reinforce something you said, Yolande. Yeah, you're right, technology isn't the solution in a lot of cases, and certainly that's it is an issue with the HCI community and you know, technically focused or computer science community, that we go in and we just want to build new technology. And often we have a technology that we're invested in and will go around, you know, it's a hammer looking for a problem or whatever. It's I work quite closely with Leona Holloway, who is actually a practitioner, was a transcriber working with blind and low vision people. And often, you know, I'll come up with a solution and she'll go, no, it's, you know, we don't need us, you know, we've got perfectly good things. So if you looked at some of the stuff that we did for the gallery, it was really low tech. It was just sticking pieces of fabric on cardboard. And that was a better solution than anything high tech. So I think that's really important. And I think it's really important to get input from practitioners, caregivers, as well as from the end users as well, whenever you're doing this sort of research.
Okay, thank you very much for your answers. I think you brought very interesting topics, such as whether technology is a solution, the experimental or features or more exploratory features of some disciplines, risk, and a very important topic, which is funding. And where is the funding going? To which disciplines and which projects? I think it's an interesting question. But I also have another one. So considering your disciplines in sociology, anthropology, computer science, and HCI, What are our common and different ethical commitments, theoretical conceptualizations, methodologies and methods and paradigms? And using those differences or commonalities, how do these affect the life, the lives of older people, design and roles of age tech, and adoption of age tech? I can repeat the question if you need. It was a bit quite a long question.
It was a lot in that question. I tried to write it down. I've just unmuted myself, which may have been a mistake because I'm not entirely sure how to answer it. I caught the start of the question, which was what are the common and different ethical commitments? And I think there's a really key common ethical commitment, which is do no harm. And technology can, like, we can think that we're going to be, that we've designed something that's improving people's lives and that it's going to have positive impacts. But we always need to be mindful of the possibility that there might be unintended negative impacts. And we need to, be careful, watch, plan carefully to limit that, but also be mindful of the fact that when we do introduce technologies into real world settings, and I think it's really important, all of the examples that we've talked about, the studies that we've reflected on, have all been technology in people's lives, in real world settings, in the gallery, in people's homes, in the aged care facility. And I think it's really important to understand what happens when it goes out into the world, and to be ready to adapt, make changes, and to be mindful of the potential that there might, it might not always be a positive outcome. It might be that this is not the right thing for this situation, as Yolanda said. It might be that technology is not the solution in this particular setting. Yeah, so that's the ethical, common ethical commitment.
I left the question on the chat in case you want to read. Do you, Kim or Yolandi, want to say anything?
I can go next. Just to build on what Jenny was saying, really. I think my experience, and maybe it's just through work with Sarah, is that anthropology is quite a advanced sort of ethical understanding of its, how it works with participants, how it sees people as collaborators and partners in research. And I know anthropology hasn't always had that history, but I think contemporary anthropology has very strong ethical commitments in its methodological sort of stance, whereas some other disciplines, and I'm just making generalizations here, but I have seen in some studies in computer science and to a lesser extent probably in HCI, a more sort of extractive logic around particularly the qualitative research. So more kind of the framing of participants as subjects, even the phrase users, I think is quite problematic because it limits people to a particular role in relation to technology. Whereas, you don't just have to use technology. You could admire it. You could, watch it. You could play with it. You could throw it out, put it in the bin, you put it in a cupboard, throw away the key. There's lots of kind of different ways in which you could think about people's relationships to people beyond their role as users or consumers. And anthropology, I think, has a better way of sort of framing that. So some of the framings of people, and I guess this is also speaks to the question of methodological differences, some of the framings of people in the computer disciplines, I think, are a little bit problematic. And where that becomes an issue in some studies with particularly older people or anybody who's in a sort of vulnerable position, is that it can create further vulnerabilities. Jenny spoke really well about the complexities about doing research with older people. And I know everybody, Kim, your work's across, very much across this as well, where, you can't just sort of leave something with people and walk away. You also can't assume that they're going to be okay with it, that they're going to even be able to use it. And so there's often, a huge amount of personalized support that sort of needs to wrap around any project with people in general, but with older people specifically, I think. We had a whole technical support team working with the older people that were in our study. We had a whole series of storms and power outages that knocked all the technology out regularly throughout the trial period. And we had to have people on hand to sort of reset, to go in, you know, and also to remove stuff and when people became uncomfortable with it. Like, it was very resource intensive trial, and involved a lot of close collaboration with the participants and really kind of checking in with them regularly about not just the research itself, but the whole, you know, giving and asking them to do something with technology. So I think that the social sciences really helped our team navigate that. I'm sure, look, I'm not trying to say anything terrible about HCI, because I know that there's also some really fantastic ethical research going on in that field. It's just, I think that anthropology is more kind of done a lot more thinking about that in terms of its disciplinary roots.
I think what you're saying is fair. I think HCI is a younger field, and it is very much a smorgasbord. I mean, people have come from all different sort of backgrounds, and HCI brings all of those different sorts of perspectives together. And perhaps, I mean, ethics has, I guess, always been somewhat important, but it hasn't been recognised as important as it is starting to be now. There, HCI is drawing on methods from sociology and anthropology. I've recently started doing, you know, value-centered design, analysing things like that. I think that's really important. I think HCI can learn from other disciplines to consider ethics more. I just wanted to quickly talk about, what are some of the ethical issues that, at least for me, are important? I feel like we want to make sure that what we're doing is that it's not being driven by, and this is something Jenny said earlier, financial implications. You know, that we're just developing technologies that are a replacement for care providers. This shouldn't be just about a cost-cutting exercise, but rather an enhancement of life and current care. And, you know, then, you know, the sort of issues that technologists tend to focus on are probably things like privacy, bias in AI, and to some extent, equity as well. And, you know, making sure, you know, how do we make sure that the technologies that were being developed are actually going to be able to be used by all of the people who are going to be, you know, who would benefit from using those technologies.
Thank you very much for your answers. Now, my final question let's not spend more than 7 minutes, because then we have audience discussion. So how could we foster collaboration between social sciences and computer science? Or, for example, what an ideal team setup would you recommend for future projects in industry or academia? And how is the aging technologies industry positioning this? Are they actually embracing interdisciplinarity? Do you have any take on that? Or is it still more traditional dominating and traditional roles?
I can tackle the end part of that question. There's a lot in there. I just wanted to reflect on my experience working with an aged care provider here in Australia, McLean Care, who are just a wonderful partner to work with, and certainly really understood the value of interdisciplinary research and were very keen to kind of understand, you know, the opportunities for them as a regional care provider. So just to put that in context for those of you who aren't in Australia, Australia's a, you probably know, a very big dispersed country, and in the regional areas it's very hard to get healthcare workers, aged care workers to go out and work in those communities. It's also quite difficult to access people in their homes and actually provide care. So there is a need for other alternatives to people, which, you know, in certain situations we just simply can't provide. This project also happened to coincide with the pandemic when we couldn't also take and put people in, we couldn't offer care, person-based care in people's homes and in many settings in Australia because of lockdown restrictions and also health concerns. So we didn't actually know that when we were planning the project, but it ended up being that way. So having, you know, I guess it's an interesting contrast to what I said before, where technology isn't always a solution. In this situation, people couldn't always be the solution, and there did need to be some other form of care provided through technology. And so this trial was all about seeing how far smart home devices could go. Now, the recommendations and the conclusions of that study were, you know, quite similar to what Jenny was saying earlier, which is basically that, you know, this is never going to be able to be just a standalone replacement form of care. It absolutely has to be augmented and there to support a person-based care system. And it will always need support wrapped around it, which in many ways is probably going to be more intensive in terms of the people involved. But, they might not all be health workers. There might be a different kind of type of skill-based required in terms of what that system looks like, but there are still going to need to be people there. So, you know, that particular provider has sort of gone on to look at other innovative solutions for their regional communities. Another problem they have is just providing older people with access to healthcare services, so not even in-home care, but just access to doctors, access to specialists, particularly for people who can't get in a car and drive somewhere. So there's all sorts of, you know, mobility-based challenges in regional Australia that do need other forms of technology to support that. And I think providers like McLean Care are very, very keen to make that happen so that they can support care in the communities that they are working in.
Can I jump in with some comments to that? I think, Yolanda, talking about the importance of human care, that aligns with what I was going to say in response to the first part of that question, which was the question is, how could we foster collaboration between social sciences and computer science in the context of designing technology for older people? And I think what's missing there is actually also collaborating with the care disciplines, healthcare, nursing, occupational therapy, and so on. I think it's broader than social science and computer science. There's a much bigger kind of ecosystem of disciplines involved who should be part of this conversation. I think what's a bit frustrating is often these different disciplines are doing this work individually without talking to each other. And I encounter quite a lot of people in the care disciplines, healthcare. I'm working with music therapists at the moment. And sometimes I encounter people who haven't come across HCI. They don't understand that it's a discipline that exists in its own right. So I think it's really important that we somehow build connections between these different communities who are all working towards a similar goal of, designing usable, useful, valuable technologies to enable people to live a better life in later life.
So Monash has just set up, our Assistive Tech and Society Centre, and that's designed to be interdisciplinary. It's got 80 people from across Monash from a variety of different disciplines, and everybody says they want to work together, but then they don't work together because they're still stuck in their own discipline. They've got their own methodologies. They've got their own ways of thinking about the problems, their own sorts of problems that are important to them. And it is really difficult to work with people from another discipline. It takes a long time to learn the language, to understand where they're coming from, to understand they have a very different perspective. And I mean, that's incredibly valuable and rewarding, but it takes quite a while to do it. So there's a lot of inertia and there are a lot of reasons not to work together. So Jenny or Yolandi, what do you have any suggestions for how you get people, these interdisciplinary teams, to work together or to foster collaboration?
I don't know. Sorry, Hugo.
What, do you want some tips for your centre, Kim?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't mind taking something away, but yeah. No, I just think it is quite tricky. And I mean, look, the funding is one way. I mean, because I think for any big project, if you want to get significant funding from industry or from government, it certainly helps if you've got a multidisciplinary team, but often they're just multidisciplinary teams on paper, and it's hard to get them to actually really work together and actually really sit down and, have a proper transdisciplinary approach to the problem.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think definitely through the funding path is the, because most projects in this space do want interdisciplinary teams, and so in order to attract and get the funding, you do need to assemble an interdisciplinary team. With our Smart Homes for Seniors project, we had we actually involved the technical researchers from Deakin in the ethnography, and that was great because they actually got to be part of the ethnographic research and see what we were doing, and we also had access to all of their data, and we could kind of put the two together in terms of, okay, this is what we found with the ethnography and here's the data that may or may not support it from the actual devices themselves. So it just, enabled quite a collaborative and constructive dialogue between the two teams. So that's my very short suggestion.
Jenny, do you have anything very quick to say before we jump into the audience participation?
I don't really have any suggestions. I just wanted to just emphasise what Kim said is very true. It's really difficult for that interdisciplinary, genuine collaboration to happen because people have, a long, long history of being trained in a particular discipline, and it's really hard to learn the language and learn the methods for other disciplines. So, yeah, it's really challenging.
Okay, so thank you very much for all your insights. So let's continue this conversation with the audience. Does anyone want to say anything? If not, I have no questions. Okay. I think Jason is asking something. Yes. Jason is saying, I wonder if you gathered insights about gendered use of technology in the smart home, but also thinking about the F1 VR and if gender inequalities informed your research. I think this question is more for Jenny, but I don't know.
I was going to leave it for Yolandi to answer because I know you're an expert on gender and technology. But I think with the VR, yes, look, because I didn't have time to go into detail about that study, but we were not introducing VR, but learning from caregivers' experiences of using VR. And that the volunteer who introduced the Formula One activity did have a lot of examples from men that he had met and worked with and used VR with. So I don't know if that was, we didn't really look at the gender issues, but anecdotally, certainly there seemed to be interest in his particular experiences with connecting with men's interests through VR. But there's also been the video that I had at the start of my presentation that didn't really play but was supposed to play in the background, that was a really, really enthusiastic woman who, in a trial we were conducting with VR from a different study, we did go in and trial a VR, and there was a resident who was so enthusiastic about it and really, really enjoyed the experience. And, if we make an assumption that these interactive technologies are for more going to be of more interest to men than women. That didn't quite gel with that particular experience, but yeah, I'm going to hand over now.
Yeah, so I've done quite a lot of research on smart homes and gender, and I guess the quick answer is that generally we find that men are more interested in installing, operating and maintaining smart homes to the point where it actually creates additional, it's called digital housekeeping in home environments, and there's a whole gender debate around that if you want to check it out. Just look up digital housekeeping and gender and you'll find quite a lot of literature in that space. However, when you get to older people, the gender imbalance in interest and uptake is, I think, reduced. So we certainly haven't seen it as pronounced in the Smart Homes for Seniors project. And I think that is because the digital inclusion with older adults tends to be lower in general. And less, there's sort of less competency overall in terms of so we have in Australia that it's called the Digital Inclusion Index, which I'll pop in the chat in a moment, and it includes quite a lot of research about older adults here.
We can't hear you. Yolanda, I think you are muted.
Sorry, I'm not sure when I went on mute.
Yeah, we can hear you now. Sorry, there was a technical problem.
I don't know where I got to, so I'm not quite sure. But so I was just saying that, yeah, with older adults, it's less pronounced, and there's a digital inclusion index, which sort of points to the issues more broadly in the older adult population. And I think that that's why we sort of see less of that gender difference when we get into the older community. And in fact, you know, also because there's so many other health concerns and issues. So in our study with Smart Homes for Seniors, quite often it was actually in a heterosexual partnership, it was the woman who was sort of really interested in the program and sort of taking it forward. There were a couple of households where some of the participants had quite significant health concerns, bordering on dementia in a couple of cases, and where that occurred, of course, it was the other partner that was really, you know, setting everything up and making sure that the trial was sort of going smoothly. So there was just more variation in that older age group, which changes the gender dynamic.
The person who made the question can read it aloud, in otherwise I can do it for her or him. Blanca, do you want to read your question?
Thank you, Miguel. Yes, first of all, I would like to thank the presenters, the speakers, because it has been extremely interesting, very rewarding, and thank you for your insights and sharing your experiences in the topic and also the interdisciplinarity. I'm Blanca de Usdat. I'm a professor, associate professor at the University in Tarragona in Spain. And I coordinated a project on digital co-creation. We developed a platform for digital co-creation of long-term care services. And it was an interdisciplinary project with technologies. Also, all the stakeholders were involved. I mean, practitioners, social sciences, anthropologists, sociologists, and was exactly very, very, as Jenny Wycott said, very, very challenging, because we need to make a glossary of different words. And I mean, all our work about what was meaning in each disciplinary word also, you know, was oriented from social sciences, led by social sciences, but technologies were very pushing. So it was a kind of trust, also disciplines, and was quite challenging, but very, very interesting. And my question was about if you have experience about the approach of co-creation, was mentioned by Kim Marlott about the co-design and the involvement of all the adults in the design, and the use of these technologies, of these methodologies, better to say. It is not easy to get involved, but I agree that we cannot be ageist. There are older adults that have skills, have digital literacy. So how do you see this methodologies as a way, as an approach to get more technology adapted to the real person needs and what people want and all this that we have said that is important. And also we found in this platform that there was need also a facilitator that we could not only put, but the role of the facilitator was important. And I think this was a good point that you three had, no? That the person needs to be there apart from technology. We cannot throw technology to use and that's it. Well, anyway, that's just, I wanted your comments on this and thank you very much. It was very rewarding.
Thank you. I think co-creation and co-design, I think they're probably different ways of describing the same thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're really important but really challenging. And there is often an expectation that is the process we will follow, but I'm not sure it's always done well or in the way I think different people think in different ways about this idea of co-creation, and so it can be really challenging to do it in a way that's genuine and that involves people from the start and involves people in decisions about what's going to be created. Often it can be, it can end up being a tick boxing exercise, and I think that's a challenge we have to kind of manage in this area. The other thing I would say is that it's really important for it not to just be something that happens in research, but it's also something that happens in industry. And I think there's, you know, growing awareness that we have to involve people in the design process. In one of the projects I've worked on, we worked closely with a group of older adults who we called the Technology Explorers, and they took part in workshops over 18 months to help us develop a social virtual reality experience. But we modelled that Technology Explorer idea on Longevity Explorers, who are a group of people in San Francisco who get involved in discussions about designing technology, evaluating technology with startups and with companies that are actually designing for older people. And I think that's a really useful model.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. I agree, because sometimes technology, you know, as was said also a little bit, I think try to be disruptive and innovative and a bit dystopic, and then reality and what is needed is another way, no? So I think it's very good. And yeah, engagement was something challenging, but we had the help. It was an European project called Socatela. I just put the web. It finished in 2001. And well, the engagement was helpful through social services and healthcare services. And anyway, but yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I'd just like to say something too. I think co-creation or co-design is imperative, and but as Jenny said, I think sometimes it's hard to get particularly technologists to really do it properly and to listen. I think it's really important it's done from the very beginning to make sure that you're dealing with real problems rather than problems that technologists think of problems, or at least might be something that's amenable to their technology. And I think it's important to try and get as many of the different sort of stakeholders involved as possible early on. So it's not just the people who are going to be using the technology, but it's, you know, also the who's going to be funding the technology, who's going to be, staff who are working in the aged care facility, you know, who aren't directly going to be using the technology, what are going to be some unforeseen impacts that it's going to have on them, and just trying to get all of those people in a room talking together and understanding how the whole ecosystem is going to be impacted by the technology or the solutions that you're trying to develop. It's really important to do that from the very start.
Thank you, totally agree.
Thank you, Blanca, for your questions. Kalindi Sharma has two very interesting questions. Maybe you can say it aloud or I can read it for you otherwise. Well, okay, I can read it. She said something. Oh, okay, read it. Yes, so Kalindi asks, what about the access to a varied social demographic? In the Indian context, access and comfort seems to be quite the concern. The aging population of a particular demographic tend to look towards a trusted caregiver, family in most cases, before initiating a process guided by technology. And she has a follow-up question. As an anthropologist in India, working for the government as a tenured, I'm reminded of my marginalized position every day, given the entire focus is on STEM research. So pretty much relegated to the margins. Interdisciplinary collaborations mean that the principal investigator will be a technologist and social scientists, humanities scholars will be advisors to a specific domain alone. How do we overcome such biases in the academic community, because these biases resonate with the policies of funding agencies?
I can have a go at that, and thanks very much for the question, Kalindi. I do empathize with the comments. I've certainly experienced that in my career, actually mainly as an energy social scientist, because you know, that area, the energy area, is so technology and engineering led in particular. And so often the social science is sort of brought in when the problem has already been framed, you know, the solution is often already there. And it's really, you know, my job is to help engineers understand how to get people to accept whatever solution they've come up with. So I do appreciate that position. Having said that, you know, that hasn't been my experience with the aging care research. And there are some, you know, gems of projects where I've seen that situation reversed. Certainly in the Smart Homes for Seniors project, I really felt like it was a genuine collaboration between the social and technical sciences, and the industry partner really wanted the anthropological work front and center. In fact, they were more interested in that than the technical, and the technical was just augmenting the social research. So that was a really wonderful project to be part of. I do now, you know, I'm very aware of my own privilege in academia and the luxury I have to have more say in projects. Appreciate it's a lot more difficult when you're earlier in your career, and also if you're kind of in a more marginalized position. But nowadays I have a lot more opportunity to influence the direction of research. And if I do see projects where, you know, there isn't a really genuine and collaborative role for the social sciences, I question my involvement, or I make requests and have conversations about that with the team and see if there's anything that can kind of be changed. And mostly people are very open to that, because I think more and more I'm seeing all sorts of sectors, not just the kind of health sector, but also other sectors that I work in, being very open and really recognizing anthropology and social sciences more generally as being part of it. I'm also, I mean, another little piece of information, I guess, from over here in Australia is that our degree programs, our double degree programs with the humanities, now have the highest rate of graduation of any degree at Monash University. So they have the highest industry demand of any degree at the university, which I just think is an astounding kind of statistic or fact. And what that tells me is that industry is increasingly valuing people with skills across the humanities and the technical domains. And that is what they're recognising that they're really missing and or needing. And so I do see that as a kind of broader shift in industry, at least here in Australia. I can't speak to other locations around the world, but certainly here, you know, real valuing of social science research and input as really absolutely essential to solving not just the issues in the aging sector or the healthcare sector, but, you know, issues more broadly. So That's my my take on that one. Kim and Jenny, did you want to add anything to that?
I didn't really have anything to add. I think sometimes in my experience, the technologists on a project can often be in service of people from other disciplines who are leading the ideas, because the technology is usually being developed to serve a particular purpose, and sometimes it's the people who've got that purpose in mind who are leading the project. So that, yeah. I think your other comment about the socioeconomic differences, I think that's really important, and it's something that we need to be aware of. Yeah, I think a lot of the research we do tends to just focus on particular groups, and we need to be mindful of the diversity of the aging population.
Yeah, I don't have anything more to add to that, except I think that's really important. Think about different countries and the different conditions in those countries. Be aware of that.
Perfect. So is there any other question from the audience? Maybe another or a comment. You don't need to ask anything. I think Simon wants to say something.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking about sort of the discipline that we've talked less about, but that one of you mentioned, now I can't remember who it was, but sort of the people working in aged care or the caregivers, whether formal or informal. And I often see, so I work with people with dementia in nursing homes and technologies in nursing homes. And I often experience staff not having the skill set or being educated to do what's now needed with technology. So I feel like there's quite a radical change in what their tasks are happening right now. And I think, so I don't have like a clear question, but I think that's important to keep in mind. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about this kind of changing. Maybe it's also completely new people that come in. Maybe we have to rethink these disciplines. Do you have any thoughts?
I think we have to be mindful too that people were, certainly in Australia, and I think it's probably across other countries as well, but people working in that environment are often really overworked and stretched, and they've got way too much to do in a short amount of time. And it's really difficult to introduce, a new task, because technology often becomes a task in itself, even though it's supposed to support what people are doing. Often it becomes the focus. So being mindful of what kind of environment people are working in and incorporating that into the way we're designing technology is really, really important.
Okay, so if Yolandi and Kim have nothing to add to this comment from Simon, I think we can wrap up the session. Thank you very much to the audience. We have audience from India, Europe, so I think we are very lucky in that sense. Also to the speakers, Yolandi, Jenny and Kim, who voluntarily came. We weren't able to pay them, so thank you very much for your time. We know you are busy, and we really appreciate it. Please, if you have any questions about to the audience and to you about the HNET and also the Applied Anthropology Network, we left our email addresses at the beginning of the chat. So yes, pop us a message, an email, and. Well, thank you very much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.